everybody. This is Charles with the Barbershop Group, and I'll be your host for today. Today, we're going to get to talk to another guy next door. It's always great to be able to take a break from talking to therapists and other professionals about, some of the mental health things. It's good to just get a regular guy's perspective about some issues and find out a little bit more about what guys are dealing with, right? So that the stories are real. You know, a lot of times when you listen to therapists, or if you're listening to, somebody like a spiritual leader or a pastor or whoever, you may hear some stories and say, that couldn't be me. That would never be me. But it's different when you hear from a guy next door. And I got to tell you, man, it's an honor to be able to kind of interview a radio personality today on the show. Today, we've got Dion Showtime Chavez, okay? And he's coming from North Carolina, man. He's over in North Carolina doing his thing on the radio. Believe it or not, he is a late-night disc jockey for K97.5 WQOK out there. And, he's gonna have some things to say about the job, about his profession, man, and about his life. So, Dion, are you there?
I'm here, good brother.
Hey, man, thank you for spending some time with us today. It's good to have you on. I know a lot of times you are in the studio going solo, playing some tracks and maybe taking some phone calls. So you're on the other end of it today.
Hey, definitely feel a little weird being on this side of the fence, man. But
I hear you. I know it. You know, but yeah, man, I really appreciate you taking some time out of your day just to catch up with us and really share some really important points with the guys who are listening and the women too as well, man. You know, at this point, we probably have a 50-50 split in our listeners. And that's an awesome thing to know that although we target men, there are women who are listening in as well. And it just means a lot. It lets us know that they really care. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, man, one of the first things that I wanted to talk to you about, obviously, was, you know, we came across you because of an interview that you did with NPR. And I know a lot of people who are listening, they've probably never heard of you before, but they've probably heard of your story or a similar story before in their lives, man, because I mean, it's very common, but we don't get close, you know, up close and personal with it. So, you know, how did you start out working with a radio show out there? How'd you get into that?
Well, I've been in radio for 18 years. This is my 18th year in radio. So I did radio for 10 years in Virginia in the Hampton Roads area. If anybody is familiar with Hampton Roads, 757 area code. I did radio for 10 years out there. And, just after doing radio there, in the midst of that, I became a father. And my daughter's mother moved from Hampton Roads down to Raleigh. When my daughter was about maybe a little bit younger than that. They moved to Raleigh, and we were doing kind of like the every other weekend visitation, and we were meeting halfway, and I was picking her up in an area called Emporia, Virginia, for those who are familiar with that area. So we would meet in Emporia, Virginia, so it would be about an hour and a half drive for me to meet her halfway. And, you know, after about 5 years or so, I just kind of got tired of doing that. I got kind of tired. My daughter actually got sick. She got sick with a rare heart condition 1 year when she was about 5 years old. And I had to rush down here that day to see her in the hospital with like all of these IVs and tubes and stuff in her nose and just all of these things, man. And I just decided that at that moment that I didn't want to be a part-time parent. I didn't want to be a father who was, you know, 3 hours away. I wanted to be sure that if anything were to happen, that I would always be in close proximity. So as God would have it, I got a call in November of 2009. I got a call from the man who was a program director at the radio station that I'm currently working for in Raleigh. And, you know, he had heard about me and he had seen some videos that I had posted on YouTube and just some stuff that I've been doing around my craft, man. And he gave me a call and said, I've been hearing some things about you and, you know, I just want to have a conversation with you. So after the holidays, let's talk. So holidays went and I came down to Raleigh and we had a conversation and he said, well, I don't have a job for you, but I just want to let you know that you're on my radar. So I said, well, that's pretty much all I need. I said, well, I'm moving because I know if I move, I'm going to get a job. You know, if I get there, you're not going to not give me a job. So right. I moved here in 2010. I got a job in a call center, taking calls in a call center. And the following month, June of 2010, I got a call from the radio station saying that they had an opening yet. Praise be to God, man. They hired me in June of 2010. So I've been kind of rocking and rolling ever since.
Nice, nice. That's what's up, man. That things work out. You know, things really do work out, man. And kudos to you for making the decision to get closer to your daughter, man. If she was sick, I know that must have been extremely emotionally taxing for you to be, you know, to see her in that condition. You know, what were some of the emotions, man, that you went through seeing your daughter like that?
Well, at the time, that was the first time that I had ever seen her really sick. And, you know, this heart condition is something that I never heard of. It's called Kawasaki disease. Mm. And, you know, it was something that there wasn't a whole lot of information out there about. And so it was painful, you know, just having to take a 3-hour ride from Virginia to Raleigh to see your child in that position. And you're not knowing, okay, is this something that's going to be long lasting? Is she going to need some sort of transplant? I didn't know a lot about the illness, because it's not like, oh, she has the flu or she has, you know, something that's common that we hear about all the time. So, you know, the unknown sometimes is what eats you alive when you're going through situations like this. So I was afraid, you know, I was really afraid for her, and just walking in that room and just seeing her, man, at the age of 5 with, like I said, just tubes and IVs and nurses kind of like poking and prodding at her, and just seeing her just laying there helpless, man, it was a hard pill to swallow. And it was hard for me to see her. She stayed in the hospital for 3 or 4 days until they could, you know, get her back to normal, until her heart condition had improved and they were able to finally go ahead and release her. But it was just a struggle for me to see, as it would be for any parent, to see my child laying in that situation and laying in that bed just helpless without the ability to get up and move around as a rambunctious 5-year-old should. You know, she was just kind of stuck, and it, you know, it hurt me, man. And like I said, that fueled a lot of the decisions that I made when it came to, like, was I going to stay in Virginia, or was I going to make the move and move down to Raleigh to be closer to her?
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you, man. I'm glad she's doing much better, man. You know, that's scary. It's always scary when it involves the heart and things like that, man. So I want to ask you, you know, like, what motivated you to get into radio, though? Like, were you a music fanatic? Were you an aspiring artist? Like, what went into that?
Yeah, well, I've been a music lover forever. I fell in love with hip-hop when I was 7 years old, back in 1987 when I first discovered Big Daddy Kane. So, yeah. You know, okay. I was fortunate enough to grow up in the golden era of hip-hop. So, huge fan of, you know, the Wu-Tangs and the Jay-Z's and the Nas and Common and Biggie and, you know, a lot of the East Coast hip-hop that a lot of us grew up on. It kind of formulated my childhood, and some stuff from other regions too, but mainly my ear always leaned more so towards the East Coast boom bap style of hip-hop. So as I actually went to culinary art school out of high school, I was going to be a chef, and I decided to not pursue that anymore after the first year. I was trying to figure out what it was that I wanted to do with my life and where I wanted to go, and my girlfriend at the time, who is now my wife, basically gave me the idea to write down some things that I thought that I could see myself doing and what I loved, and write down some of my passion. And really the only thing that I could think about was music. Like, that's the only thing that I was really passionate about at the age of 18, 19. I just loved music. So I decided that I wanted to be a producer. So I would go out and try to produce tracks for artists and following the footsteps of some of the great producers that I grew up listening to, like DJ Premier and Pete Rock and Pharrell Williams at the time with the Neptunes. And I would just grow up and go out and follow in those footsteps. So I, you know, got all my equipment and I got everything that I thought that I would need and everything that I thought that those guys had or what they were using to start with. I built up my home studio, living in my mom's house, man, and had like a little home studio, and I decided to make beats. And then I started to go to, I went back to school to pursue a degree in mass media, and I was going to Norfolk State, and they happened to have auditions for their radio station at the time. And I said, well, this will be dope, because I can go and get on this radio station. And at the time, like, artists would come through to college radio stations. It would be nothing for an artist to come to a city where there was an HBCU for them to come through to that particular station. And the station had just changed formats from an all jazz format, and they were playing hip hop. And I said, well, this will be a great way for me to meet people in the network. And when artists come through, I'll give them my beats. And I'll get on from, you know, this radio stuff is just temporary, and I'll end up giving them my beat. And the first person that I interviewed was a lot of, I don't know if anybody knows the group Brand Nubian, but the first person that I ever interviewed was Grand Poobah from Brand Nubian. You know, from there, once I saw that, okay, well, you know, I can meet people that I grew up listening to and meet artists that I have been a fan of for years and have the opportunity to sell beats to them or give them my beats and let them, you know, choose, and maybe, you know, they'll put me down with one of their projects. And that was my initial motivation. That was the initial thought process for me. And that just kind of transitioned into falling in love with radio and then, you know, just following that passion for radio for now what has been 18 years.
Wow, that's what's up. The Grand Poobah, man, that's crazy. That's one of your first interviews. That's something else, man. So, you know, I was reading an article about you, man, and you said something about there was a song that you listened to that made an impact on you because of the relationship that you had with your father. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I'm not sure. I mean, there's several songs that have impacted me. I'm not sure what that particular interview was about. But, you know, Edo G and the Bulldogs, Be a Father to Your Child, has always been something that stuck out to me as a message as a father, you know, because growing up in the 90s, that song was one of the, you know, it was a positive song, and it was a song about men stepping up to the plate that received commercial radio appeal. So it was one of those songs that we heard all the time. And going into being a father, that's something that I always thought about. But also Common and Lauryn Hill have a song called Retrospect for Life, which came out maybe 97, 98. And as me going into fatherhood in the early 2000s, that was a song, you know, that was the first song that ever made me cry. Because he talks about how, you know, even though he and the young lady that he was dating, they're expecting a child, and, you know, they're talking about abortion. He's going through the song and saying $315, which is the cost of an abortion at the time, that's not worth your soul. So he's talking to his unborn child through the song. And I just, you know, I felt that in my spirit, man. I felt, because we all have a choice, you know, we have a choice to whether we want to keep our, you know, if we find ourselves in a certain situation, are we going to keep the kids, or are we going to take another route, you know, whether it be abortion, whether it be giving them up for adoption, whether it be walking out of the child's life completely as a father. Mm-hmm. You know, those are all options that are there for us, but what are we going to do? So for me, it was, I already knew what my path was going to be, and that song just spoke to me in a way that let me know that as a father, I didn't have any options. My only option was to be there for my daughter the way that my father wasn't there for me. My father was shot and killed when I was 11 years old, so wow. I didn't grow up with him. So I knew that I couldn't walk away from my responsibilities of a father. I couldn't walk away from the things that I was supposed to do to be sure that my daughter had everything that she needed, and that she had every aspect of life covered, man, that a father could bring into her life, and just kind of do the best that I could do to raise her up and rear her the best way that I could.
Yeah, I hear you. You know, so I also wanted to touch on it, because we talk a lot on the show about mental health and traumatic events and things like that. And, you know, with your father having been murdered when you were young, what kind of impact did that have on you?
Well, at the time, man, it didn't impact me at all, to be quite honest with you, because my mother and father had separated when I was very young. And my father, you know, he suffered from, you know, substance abuse and what I believe now is some mental health issues. So at the time, I wasn't really concerned, because I had my mom there, and I always knew that my mom was going to be there to give me whatever I needed. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until I became older that I started to look back and think about all of the things that I missed out on, not even necessarily as a child, but more so as a young adult and as a young man, to say, wow, I'm going through these situations, for instance, with the mother of my child. What would my life be like if I had my father to call and talk about, and I had him to talk through these issues with me? Mm-hmm. You know, as a young man, it caused me to lean on hip hop, and it caused me to lean on the figures in hip hop for my male influences. You know, at the time, I had a male cousin who was almost like a big brother to me more. So he was the one that introduced me to hip hop. But, you know, it was people like Big Daddy Kane that I looked at for what I thought being a man should look like, or people like KRS-One and Public Enemy who taught me about socially conscious things and the social consciousness of of being an African-American male in America at the time in the late 80s and early 90s. So those things, I don't know if I would have leaned on hip hop as much if my father would have been around. I don't know. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I would have had somebody to talk through these issues with. But more so for me, I think I look at now as somebody who's navigating life as a man in the 21st century, I would love to have him here now to have a conversation with. You know, he would probably, I think my dad would probably be, my mom is 60, so he was older than her. He would probably be in his mid to late 60s at this point. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I would love to have that type of bond with a man that I can call up and be like, yo, pop, guess what? Like, what's up? Like, you know, look, let me tell you about this. Look, what you think about, you know, just somebody that could give me the 60 plus years of wisdom that I would think that he would have at this point in his life.
Right.
Either lean on it.
I was going to say to you, man, when you mentioned that, what's one of the things that, like, if he were here, what's one of the things that you think you would be talking to him about today in this time?
I mean, I think we definitely be talking about politics. Like, I'm heavy into politics now, but I don't know if he would be. That's an interesting question. I don't know what his interest would be. That's a great question. I have an older sister. We have different moms, but we have the same dad. And she was around him a lot more than I was growing up. She's 7 years older than me, so she got to spend more time with him. So I'm gonna pose that question to her.
Yeah,
and I'm interested in seeing what she would have to say. But you know, I think the climate, because what I remember from him, he wasn't super, you know, he wasn't socially conscious necessarily. He loved his family. He loved his kids, definitely. But I don't know. I don't know. I think my angle would definitely be politics, but I don't know if he would be as interested in those types of things that I am, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, you talk a lot about hip hop, and, you know, that comes out of my era as well. And you talked about the influence that some of the hip hop artists had on your development or your perspective and development as a man today. Do you see, what's your take on the music scene today, the hip hop scene today, and the messaging that's being given to men? I mean, is there a corollary? Is it very different? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think hip hop has always been misogynistic, and I think hip hop has always been hypersexual to a degree. You know, I think there's always been an element in hip hop that has carried on those traits. I think now the issue is that the young folks who are listening to it have a lot more of it than we did growing up. Because people are putting out a lot more music, but they also have more access to it.
Yeah.
To whereas when we were growing up, you know, you had explicit content, and people talk about today's hip hop like it's so much different than the hip hop that we grew up in, right? Mm-hmm. But I pose this question all the time when people talk about mumble rappers, for instance, and they talk about like the Migos and Future and people like that, and I tell people all the time, Old Dirty Bastard was the first mumble rapper ever. There's nothing that Old Dirty Bastard really rapped about, like shimmy shimmy ya, shimmy yay, shimmy ya. That doesn't make sense,
right? That's right.
Das Effects, like bum stickity bum stickity bum, there's no lyrical, you know,
right.
What I mean,
there's no, yeah, lyrical, there's no linguistic creation there. There's no linguistic creativity involved in that, really,
right? You know, right. Yeah, right. Absolutely. I mean, you have to be able to do the tongue twisters and things like that, but there's no real substance in that. So the same way that I love Das Effects and I love let's say the Fushnikins, La Shmoo and things like that, that's no different than what the mumble rappers are doing today. You know what I mean? There may be more drug references and things like that today. I'll give that point, but. Yeah. You know, there wasn't any content to those lyrics at that time. So that's always been a factor in hip hop. You know what I mean?
Gotcha.
When people say, well, hip hop is too much sex in hip hop now. That's all they talk about is sex. And I would ask the question, have you ever heard LL Cool J's doing it well?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, have you ever heard Lil Kim? Yeah. So
right. There's always been sexual innuendo in hip hop and R&B. I mean, even if we go back to the early 80s, You know, you can spot it in R&B songs where if we were children at the time, we weren't thinking about it that way. But now if we go back and listen to it, it's like, hey, wait a minute, what is she talking about? Make my love come down. What is that about?
Absolutely.
So I
think, you know, it's good for the young people to have their music and the things that speak to their culture, but there's also a boatload of music on the other side of the spectrum. You know, you have your J. Cole, you have your Kendrick, you have your Rhapsody, you have your Moo Moo Fresh. Like, you have your artists out here who are giving you good quality hip hop. And yeah. I think it's up to us, if that's what you desire, you have to go out and find it. Like, it's not going to necessarily be thrown right into your face. And, you know, that's a major difference between the music scene today and the music scene of yesterday, is because there was a lot more balance at that time during the golden era. And now when you turn on the radio, you know, you're not going to necessarily hear a rapper talking about his religion. I was having a conversation with someone yesterday, and through that conversation, I realized that Kanye's Jesus Walks was probably the last time that we'll hear a hip hop song speaking to religion on the radio. We're probably never going to get that again. If we do, I'd be surprised.
Yeah.
But even like Chance the Rapper, who speaks heavily about religion in his, you know, in his music on his mixtape, those songs don't make it to radio. Yeah.
Right.
They don't make it to radio. Like Kendrick's songs, positive songs, with the exception of We Gonna Be All Right, those records don't necessarily make it to radio. Cole's positive songs don't necessarily resonate with radio. Whereas in the golden era, we had Brand New being speaking about religion. We had Rakim, who has never said a curse word in any of his music, play regularly on the radio. You know, so that's a major difference, is that you don't have the balance when it comes to mass media, whether it be radio, video, internet, whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. The positive artist may not necessarily, or the artist with a certain message may not necessarily get the same exposure as an artist whose music is kind of dumbed down, or whose music is, you know, stripped down, and it's more of the beat that drives the song than anything.
Right.
So that's a major difference. But, you know, I think it's up to us as parents. If we don't want our children to be exposed to these things, then we have to do the responsibility and do our due diligence of not only just knowing who these artists are, but steering the kids away from these artists. Like, we still control the radio in the car. We still control what our kids watch on their phone, because we're the parents.
Right.
So, you know, it's up to us. If we don't like what they're listening to, we have to give them an alternative. You know, my daughter, she loves all of the ratchet, you know, hip hop artists that are out there today. She's 14. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, she can recite Biggie lyrics, and she can recite Faith Evans lyrics, and, you know, SWV is one of her favorite groups, and Belle Biv DeVoe is one of her favorites. So all of these things have to come into play if we want to. It's all about exposure. You know, if we want to expose these kids to different things, we have to open their minds and we have to show them. You know, there's a song right now by an artist named Juice WRLD. It's a song called Lucid Dreams. And I was talking to some young brothers a couple of days ago, 13 to 14 year olds. And I said, yo, you know, this song is it's a Nas sample. This song was sampled from Nas. And I'm like, what? And I was like, yeah, this is this huge song that this guy has. He's a huge artist now. Is a sample from Nas. So that opens your minds to want to go back and now explore who Nas is and explore Illmatic and It Was Written and things like that have kind of stood the test of time when it comes to hip hop culture and quality hip hop over the years.
Yeah, absolutely, man. So, you know, you talked about parenting and our influence as parents. And, you know, I can't let you go without talking to you about some of the work that you are doing in North Carolina with fathers, man. You know, I think that it's really awesome what you're doing out there. And I think that the people need to really, really understand this initiative that you have started there in North Carolina. So what kind of inspired you to start this initiative to help fathers?
Sure. Well, I wanted my test to be a testimony. So the things that I went through as far as fighting for custody of my daughter, going back and forth to court for years and years and years, just fighting for my rights as a father. I wanted that to be what I use to help other people. The courts will refer to us as non-custodial parents a lot of times, and that's a phrase that I really despise. And I wanted to do something and to use my story to help brothers out there who may not have the resources. Like I spent thousands of dollars on lawyers' fees. I spent thousands of dollars on private investigators and court costs and things like that, just fighting for my right to have an equal amount of time with my child.
Wow.
And I know that there are brothers out there who may not be as resilient as I was when it comes to this situation, because they may not have the resources, or they may not think they have the tools that they need to be a part of, not only just to fight the fights that come along with these types of situations when you and the mother of your children are always together, but just to be a part of your children's lives. As men, a lot of times we think that we need the most money and we need to have the most gifts for our kids, and we have to give them the best shoes and clothes, when basically these kids only want your time, you know, and that doesn't cost you anything.
Right.
So I decided to start going out and doing, not just in North Carolina, but around the world, just teaching fathers about the importance of being involved in the life of your children, because a lot of times we don't necessarily think about the recourse that comes when we aren't involved. Research has shown that when a father is involved in the life of a child, that child is less likely to get involved with drugs and alcohol. That child is less likely to be engaging in promiscuous activities. That child is less likely to drop out of school. You know, and as fathers, we all have that innate desire to want our children to do better than we do, and want our children to be better than we are. So sometimes we forget that it's work. You know, being a father is the hardest job that I've ever had. I've got a 14-year-old, I've got an 8-month-old, and it is the hardest thing that I've ever done in my life. But I know that God granted me with these blessings for a reason. He trusted me with his greatest gift. So it's up to me to not only protect them and to make sure that they're safe and secure, but to guide them and lead them in these formative years. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see years from now the impact that myself as a father and a lot of the fathers out here are having on this next generation. And I truly believe, man, that we can change the world. And as fathers, if we just step up to the plate and just do what we have to do for this generation that's following us, we can make a huge dent and make a difference, and, you know, really create the next generation of leaders and the next generation of thinkers and the next generation of people who are going to go on and to do really great things. But we have to be present. We have to do everything that we have to do to be sure that our children know that we're there for them, to be sure that we provide for them, to be sure that we guide them and we keep them encouraged, man, because it's rough out here. You know, it's real in this world we're living in. And these babies need our guidance, man. We just have to give them all that we can give them. And, you know, my main thought is always, as a man, you know, the Bible tells us we're supposed to leave an inheritance for our children's children's children. So I want my legacy and my inheritance to be based off of, you know, what I'm doing and the foundation that I'm laying for these kids today.
Yeah, absolutely, man. You know what? I totally agree with you as a father, man. I think about that all the time. I really appreciate you spending some time with us today. I'm glad that we were able to catch up, man. And I really, really enjoyed the information that you shared. And I know that the other listeners will enjoy it as well. I wanted to mention to you guys out there that, again, you know, Deion's on the radio out there in North Carolina, but he also has his YouTube channel. And we'll put that in the show links for you. You can catch up with him on Instagram at The Glad Dad. He has a lot of announcements out there. He's doing some public speaking all around the country now. And, you know, guys, it is a really wonderful person just to get to know. Okay. Just another guy out there who's breaking the stereotypes. Okay. And doing the things that he has to do for his family and for himself. Deion, man, I appreciate you coming in. I really do.
You know, brother. I appreciate you having me, man. It's been an honor to have this conversation with you. I'm always open to talking and having dialogues about how we can move this needle and how we can get things to where they need to be, not only for us, but like I said, for that next generation that's coming behind us.
Absolutely. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, guys, again, you have been listening to Deion Showtime Chavez, okay? And he is the nighttime radio host for K97.5 WQOK in North Carolina. You can check him out there. I'm sure if you've got iHeartRadio or iTunes, you can plug in and check him out. Do so. Look, guys, the weekend is coming up. It's actually here. And we hope that you all will be well. Don't drink too much. Spend some time with your families. Take care of your health and yourselves, okay? And be well. We will talk to you soon.
Thank you, good brother.
The Barbershop Group provides safe spaces for men to discuss issues of well-being and mental health. The Barbershop Group also serves as a resource to the community, providing consultations and public speakers through partnerships with attorneys, mental health professionals, family agencies, religious institutions, and other advocates. In the near future, the Barbershop Group seeks to renovate dilapidated residential and commercial properties in urban areas to create respite shelters for displaced men. We will also host mentorship retreats and workshops for young men and adults to foster growth through our Iron Sharpening Iron and our Rebuilding Men programs. In addition, we host a weekly podcast covering issues of mental health, homelessness, financial literacy, education, and leadership. If you would like to be a guest on our show, please email us at info@thebarbershopgroup.org. Visit our Facebook page or call 313-585-9948 for more information.